One. Okay, I think it's recording. Can you guys hear me?
I hear you, Paul.
I got Jacques Spiercoe, and I've got Josiah Wallingford on the phone. And these guys contacted me a few days ago, and they are so excited that they're going to wet themselves about Perma Ethos. And so they said, we gotta start telling people about Perma Ethos. So basically, from what little I know, and I've gone and I've looked at Jack's site about this, and I guess it's actually Josiah's site, perhaps. But I've gone and I've looked at, I think it's, is it permaethos.com?
Yeah, I'd say it's our site, but it's permaethos.com.
So I've gone and I've looked at permaethos.com, and I tried to ramp up on it a little bit. I think I listened to like a half an hour of Jack talking about Perma Ethos on a special little – it's not – I don't think it's in your regular podcast stream. I think it's just an audio thing of you talking about it.
And so if you heard that, forget what you heard, because that's probably before the government messed the first idea up and we changed it.
I think I heard of version one, and I think you emailed me about version two.
Correct.
And you had me go and look about version two, and I think I spent 2 hours trying to ramp up on version two.
Okay.
And then it seems like it was about 2 weeks ago that you were telling me about version three. And mostly what you were talking about is, I did this without Kickstarter. Neener, neener. I think that was your message. Neener, neener.
No, I didn't mean it that way. I was just, no. I just know you kick ass with Kickstarter.
Funded without your nasty Kickstarter.
Yeah, exactly. I didn't think they needed 8% of our community's money.
So I went, and I think on this, and this is what you've got now. Is you've got version three is fully going 100%. It's funded to the gills, and this is what we're going to talk about today. And from what little I understand, the idea is that you allowed about 1,300 people to give you a few hundred bucks and then take that money to get the Perma Ethos project, Perma Ethos template, started at a farm, 110 acres in West Virginia. But the idea is that once you get it nice and polished, then it's going to be something that's going to be able to rubber stamp onto a bunch of farms.
Yeah, go ahead.
So the money that was brought in so far is one thing is you got a videographer there, and then the function of the videographer is that you kind of want to do exactly the same thing that Jeff Lawton is doing with his PDCs, only completely different.
That's a good way to put it. Yes.
Yes. Okay. So I think Jeff Lawton asks for 1,000 Australian dollars to be in his PDC, and I think what you're trying to do is do a PDC that's going to be the Jack and Joe show. So it's a little it's going to be just like Jeff's, but it's going to smell a little different.
It's going to be, in the words of Thomas Chong, it's the same but different, man.
Yeah, and so the first 1,000 people that jumped on board, it was $300 at pop.
Correct.
And so, for my listeners that are also your listeners that found out about it right away, they got to get in on that. And it's like, how quickly did you sell out the 1,000 tickets?
2 hours, 47 minutes.
Oh, my.
And we did a really good job of building up to it. And I think a big part of it was the way that we marketed it. We view those first 1,000 people as true partners in getting Perma Ethos off the ground and making it into what it can become. The farm that we have, none of the money went to buy the farm because we took on two additional partners into the company, Kevin and Charlie, along with Nick Ferguson from Permaculture Classroom. Joe and myself make up the full ownership board. And Kevin and Charlie own the farm. So they're basically our partners. They have a stake in the company, and they're also our first clients. So it's their farm, and there's certain components on that farm of development that they fund, and there's certain things that we fund. And what we wanted to do is, I know you're very familiar with Joe Salatin's concept of fiefdoms and all, and but he also has the philosophy of, well, you go lease a piece of land, run hogs on it, make money, and move on with your life. Well, that's fine, but the guy that's leasing land to run hogs and chickens and cattle is never going to plant trees. So we came up with this model where we actually partner with the landowner. We install a staff, and that staff is made up of a head farm steward. And on this first farm, that's Joe, a couple tenant farmers. And with this farm, there's so much work to be done. And Joe's so basically one man, a one-legged man in an ass-kicking contest at this point, that we're actually going to add a third one here. And that's part of what we wanted to be on about today. We install that crew. We fund salaries for some, and then part of it the landowner funds as a fee back to us. And we establish, design, develop, and build that farm. We run educational programs to help offset things. Generally, the way we make a decision about do we pay for it or does the client pay for it is it something that's basically just straight up profit generation, for instance, seed or something like that, or is it something that's portable? Then PermaEthos would fund that. If it's something that's building a building that's going to stay put on that farm, even if they decide they want to terminate the relationship, well, then the landowner pays for it. But we'll oversee it. We'll help design it. We'll help develop it. We set up housing. We bring in Wompfers, which is sort of like a woofer, but different. We'll tell you about that in a second. And we actually develop and build that farm. And we bring in expertise from ourselves and from our partners. We also have an advisory board made up of folks like Jeff Lawton's on our advisory board, Ben Falk's on our advisory board, Darby Simpson's on our advisory board to sanity check our design decisions. And our goal is to build this farm into a working, functional, profitable farm, develop a template from that, and then say to people, okay, get in line, bring us your farm, because we can only do so many at a time. And as we develop this, it's kind of like an ongoing system. So you've got Joe installed as the head farm steward. We've got two tenant farmers working under him. They're designed to come up and take his job, and either Joe goes off and runs another farm, or Joe kicks them out and they go run another farm. So we install them as a new farm steward and bring in new tenant farmers. And we want that system to continuously bifurcate so that we're putting more and more farms in every year. And the crazy thing is we just got started with this one, Paul, and you know, we're not scraping looking for new farms. We have people lining up already, and we're like, give us some time. We've got to make this one work. And Joe can tell you more about what's actually going on at the farm, but we took on a hell of a challenge with this place. Our view is that when we're done with this, if you want to see anything else that looks like it, you're going to Austria.
Okay, all right. Austria, I think we're talking about Sepp Holzer's place.
Yeah, with the elevation changes. And I don't know we'll do as much school culture as Sepp, but the elevation changes, the water flows, what has to be done to make this property work is the same type of challenge as Sepp had from elevation changes. It's not as alpine, but the same type of change, you know, the same type of slope.
Right. You've got a video somewhere. You sent me a link to a video, and I watched a video that kind of gave an idea, and I thought, you know, it looked a bit like my land, except that the conifer trees are replaced with deciduous trees.
Correct. We've got a great ecosystem to start with, and like I said, Joe can tell you more about what's going on there, because I'm in Texas. It's like 100 degrees, and my ducks are looking at me right now, cussing me out, saying, we used to live in Michigan, asshole. Why did you bring us here?
Okay, I got two quick things. One is that you mentioned Sepp Holzer's place, which reminds me that right now we've got Zach Weiss is selling tickets to go on a trip this August to Sepp's place for Americans. And so then they'll have all the translators, and they've got all the buses and stuff lined up. So you get over there, and they got all the – so you buy a ticket, and they take care of all the lodging and the transportation and all the education. And I think it's like a 10-day trip through Austria to see Sepp's the Kraveterhof, and then also Sepp's new place, which I think he's calling Holzerhof, and some other similar sites. So just thought I'd mention that because it seems like I just remembered it, and it should go into a podcast.
Okay.
Right. I saw that, and that looked awesome.
Yeah, I've seen some – I mean, the pictures that you get back are stunning, and there's some very cool things going on there. So it's definitely worth looking into. And I understand that when you're there, as opposed to Sepp coming here, Sepp seems about like 20 years younger. So maybe it's because of his water of life that he drinks out there or whatever. But one of the things you just said was, this is my second item, to make this work. What is the definition? What is the metric? For now it's working. What's that metric?
I'll let Joe expand on how, but what I would say the very nuts and bolts definition of that is when the farm is self-sufficient monetarily and we're not throwing funding in constantly and the client's not continuously funding expansion and it's actually running and working and producing a profit, then it's successful. It's not done and it will probably never be done, but that is our definition of success. Having a bunch of people living there, hanging out, having a good time and being able to pay the bills is not sustainable if the farm itself is not a revenue generator. So we know we can generate revenue from education. We've proven that. We've probably done more with educational revenue than most farms of that size would do in 2 years. We know we can do more with that, but that's one element of PermaEthos is the educational component. And we can't obviously run that level of educational revenue on every farm we do. So our definition of success is the farm itself being operational, functional to the point of producing sufficient revenue to pay the wages of anybody that works there and still produce a profit for the owner.
Okay. All right. So profit-based, and which is great. And it's like that's the exact same thing we're going through over here is like you've got to go through this startup phase.
It's tough.
To kind of prime the pump. You got to provide the food and pay people and stuff like that to kind of get to a certain point where things are moving forward on their own and build infrastructure. I know that one of the things we're going to be talking about here in a moment is fencing, and for me it's like earthworks. Put down the initial earthworks, and I think you guys are going to talk about that a little bit too, but. I kind of feel like for me that one of the things I would want to emphasize is that the food grown there is like 90% of the food that the people that are living there eat. And then there's more food after that. And then on top of that, you know, everybody's got an income stream and is comfortable.
And that's what we call success. And we're not there. I mean, like I said, Joe can tell you more about where we're at, but we're not there yet.
Okay.
Yeah.
I figure for us, it's 3 years. Joe?
Our phase one goal for this year is to feed everybody on site. That's our primary goal. And while we're also working on that, we're working on the infrastructure and getting the earthworks in place that need to be in place before, for example, the fencing. We have to put in the ponds before the fencing. Otherwise, we're digging up our fencing.
Paul, we have a lot less body count, I think, than you do. I think you have like 18 people living in one house or something like that. We might be up that high at times, but when you look at permanent residents, it's a much smaller head count that we're trying to feed. Joe just invested in some equipment. We have two dairy cows now, so we invested in some equipment to do cheese, butter, and things like that. So that, I mean, right now, the reason Joe said we needed to buy that stuff was he's like, if we don't, we can't drink all the milk. We're feeding it to hogs. So
right.
I think, Joe, I think you'd agree. Like that's a big boost right there in being able to convert some of the milk into, you know, other products.
Oh, big time. But the body count is also key. I mean, it takes a lot of manpower to get a farm up and running smoothly. And so right now we're at 15 people. And we'll go up to 20 at a time. But as far as people living there permanently full time, we have six people full time living there. I'm sorry,
okay.
Seven full time.
Yeah, right. You count, Joe. Don't let anybody tell you you don't count.
So now there's a house on the property already.
Yeah. The original owners of the property have a beautiful house. We're using the basement of that house right now as the bunkhouse for the woofers. And we also have this old chicken coop, which sounds horrible, but it's not. It's a beautiful chicken coop that was made of this old wood, old oak wood that when the original homestead was put in. And we've cleaned that out completely and put in power, and it's now acting as a whooper holding area, a bunkhouse, as well as the basement. And those are in place right now until we can get the primary bunkhouse built, which is another project that's being worked on.
Now, Josiah, a couple of years ago, I made a podcast with you, and part of it was that you had this vehicle that had a house on it. So it was kind of like the idea of a tiny house. It was not designed to be a land whale. It was designed to be a tiny house, and it just happened to be on a trailer which had a motor and a steering wheel.
Yeah, that was the Bluebird bus. It was actually a house built on a Bluebird bus. Beautiful. It's beautiful.
And is that getting moved to West Virginia?
No, that'll probably stay. It's in Washington, and like you said, it's not really meant to be that mobile. And taking it across the country is, you know, I just don't have the 3 months it would take to get here.
You need permits and a guy walking with a lantern in front of you screaming, bus coming through, bus coming through. It's...
They could lose a few shingles off the roof on the way.
Now Joe does want to build a Wolfati to house himself out there, but we have pushed that back in the schedule of events to meet other needs for people for expediency purposes. But Joe's goal in life seems to be to live in the side of a hill like a hobbit.
Yeah, that's exactly what I want to do. I mean, just the inspiration from the Hobbit, J.R. Tolkien's Hobbit. I mean, I want to live in one of those homes.
Isn't it amazing that your inspiration for this has come from two things, the shortest creature we can think of and the tallest?
Yeah.
Okay, now I have to emphasize, a Wolfati is an above-ground structure. It just has a very thick earthen roof. Our Wolfati workshop is going on right now, and one of the things that's been laid out is that, speaking of tiny houses, my brother Tim has said that if the logs are cut and peeled and ready to go, he believes he could build a Wolfati, a 100 square foot Wolfati, in 2 days. So, it is a very simple pole structure. Pole structures are cheaper and faster. And I think the roof design on this makes it so that the roof becomes cheaper and faster. And I've been talking to an architect, and he and I have been going back and forth, and we think that we could even get it so that this one that he builds in 2 days, it's possible that the total cost outlay for materials is under $200. So, and then this is also along the lines of, like, you know, speaking of quick, cheap housing, my brother and a couple of other people that were here for a workshop last year, they built what we called it a porta cabin, which has now been dubbed the Love Shack. it was built in 1 day. So at 9 o'clock in the morning, there was a log on the ground.
Wow.
And then by evening, it was a little cabin, and somebody slept in it that night.
I believe it's possible because this is the same but different. We seem to keep coming back on that. But I just put in an 8x8. Kind of like a tough shed style thing to house my duck flock. And so they were supposed to show up on a Friday, and I'm like, I'm taking my wife out to dinner Friday night, so I want you to get here and build my thing so I can leave, and I want it for the weekend done. And it's like 3 o'clock and the dude's not here yet. So the dude shows up, and it is prefab, everything's pre-cut, but he's like, yeah, I'll be done in 2 hours. He was by himself. He did it. 2 hours by himself, he did an 8x8 shed with shingles and windows and floor decking and the whole thing. So I think that, like, when you came up with the concept of the Wolfati, Paul, it was like, you can be whatever you want. But I think guys like your brother, once they've built a couple, if they get into the concept of it's going to basically be like this if you want package A and like this if you want package B, I believe you that it can be done relatively quickly.
So this, and then of course, you know, the thing that Josiah is probably looking forward to, while everybody else is out getting their wood in for the year to stay warm, then with the Wolfati, you don't need to heat it. It'll be warm all winter long without any heat. So
But Joe has a woman, and women's versions of warm and men's versions of warm are different. So she might need a candle to heat her room.
Okay, you got me there. Tim's wife believes that in the wintertime it's warm when it's 90.
Ugh.
So All right. I have a hard time visiting them in the wintertime because it's so hot in their house. All right. Let's bebop along. Okay. The key is PermaEthos is the template. This is the rubber stamp that can go on to lots and lots of farms. I believe you've said hundreds or even thousands of farms.
Someday, and I mean, I'm dreaming big when I say that, but I believe we can do that. Now, let's talk about the rubber stamp. It's not so much a rubber stamp. It's if you're going to be a PermaEthos farm, there's going to be certain things that have to happen, and the first few, at least, will be ones that we have personally oversaw the design, development, and implementation of, and we are looking at ways to do remote, what we call element partners for some other things that are specific to one product line or something like that. But it won't be like you just say your farm's PermaEthos. It doesn't work that way. However, we have made a commitment to the market that everything that we do will be open source. So if we come up with a plant variety, if it's patented, it'll be patented under open source so that anybody can do it. And the only reason that it would have any type of trademark or patent protection would be to prevent somebody else, like the evil people at Monsanto, from claiming ownership of it. So everything we do, from design of infrastructure to buildings to plant varieties to systems to methodologies, all of it is made available to anybody. That doesn't mean, you know, I mean, Linux is open source, but if you want someone to explain to you exactly how to build your network on it, well, you have to pay for that. So we may have some video products and things like that that are for sale. But anything that we create and publish or release is absolutely free for anybody to take and use. And I am tired of seeing things like life forms patented. And instead of bitching about it, I figure I'll go create some of we'll create some of our own and not patent them. That's our solution to the problem there. So just so people don't misunderstand, it's not like we'll just say, okay, your farm is a PermaEthos farm, rubber stamp. It is more along the lines of, you come to us, you want to partner with us, we turn your farm into a full permaculture operation, and you're then marketing your product under the PermaEthos umbrella as a brand.
Yeah,
and then for the open source side, on at least from my angle, it's out of my pure hatred for government.
I'm with you, dude. Yeah.
Well, I guess
I'll tell you, Paul, I used to have this one tiny little piece of me that still had some faith and belief in government. It was this tiny piece. It was like, they suck for all this stuff, but there's this one piece where they're still useful. And Joe, as my intern over 7 months, killed that part of me. It is dead. The only thing I'm okay with them doing now is taking care of the roads. That's it. And I'm even skeptical there.
Okay. All right. Well, now the reason why I was bringing up the whole concept of the rubber stamp is the idea of saying I wanted to differentiate between PermaEthos, the template, and Elijah's Spring, which is this current land. This is the pilot project piece of land that's going to be the place that gets the first stamp. So you're going to come along, you're going to PermaEthosify this piece of land, and then once it's all going and good and it's working, then you're going to go and say, let's do that again on the next piece. And it sounds like you've got like at least a dozen farms lined up to receive the rubber stamp after this one.
Well, the big deal is getting this farm profitable and showing that we can do that to other farms. So, for example, the monocrop farms in Kansas area, that would be a great farm to go to and say, look what we can do to your farm. Give us you have 2,000 acres here. Just give us a couple hundred, and we'll reproduce it here, and you'll want to do it on your entire property.
Okay.
And what we love about Elijah Spring is that it is a difficult property. And that is mainly due to the elevation changes there. And our hope is that because we have more funding on this property than we likely will have for future properties, we can make it into a showcase along the lines of, well, if you can do that there, if you give me a couple hundred acres of rolling hills instead of giant hills, relatively flat land, and somewhat of non-totally denuded from runoff soils, imagine what we could do there. And I think that it could, the only, my only concern is it could backfire. Because I don't know if you've noticed this, Paul, but everybody that gets into permaculture immediately says, but my land is different. Because they see Seth Holtzman and go, well, my land is flat. And you know what you and I are thinking, Paul? Well, good, then it's going to be cheap to do, right? Or it's only for the tropics. And I've actually had people tell me it's only for cold climate. So my only concern with this showcase is that people say, well, you could do that on steep land. Because it's actually very, very challenging in a lot of ways to work on steep land.
Oh,
as
yeah.
you know. As you know very well. I've been to your place. It's also steep.
It's got some steepy bits. even some cliffy bits. But I do think, though, that the one thing where you said that, like you said something about flat is easy or something like that, I think flat would be the one place where I personally would not really want to do permaculture. I think it would be harder to do permaculture on something flat. I mean, you can't control the where the cold air flows. How do you? I mean, it's like you're in one great big frost pocket. You can't get away from it.
Remember this guy that used to own the country, run the country, named Clinton, and he said it depends on what your definition of is. I think it depends on what your definition of flat is.
Okay.
If you're talking, you know, the what do they call it? The where they run the cars, the salt flats, right? Yeah, that's pretty flat. But I mean, what we're talking is like not straight up in the air. So. A rolling hill, and most farm property is that way unless you're in river bottoms. There's not a lot of, like, you know, rolling pin style flat. That I actually think that that's easier than a lot of people think, and unless you're dealing with really northern climates when you talk about frost pockets, it's still pretty easy, but maybe it's a little bit boring. Some elevation changes are great because you do have the ability to deal with the flow of temperature, and also to move water for free is a very nice thing to be able to do. But land like you have, land like Elijah Spring, is difficult when you're at that level just to get equipment in there. When you contract something instead of doing it yourself, contractors always want a little bit more because of the environment. It's a little bit more problem with access. When you're running workshops and you have 50 people that want to come, it's a little bit harder to give them all a place to park. So there's challenges there that don't exist when you're in relatively flat land. And you could think about, like, the workshop we all went to together. You, Paul, myself, and Joe were all there. The SEP one in Montana.
Right.
That was steep and flat, right? It was both. And,
yeah,
and,
yeah.
And we don't have both. We have one, just the steep part.
And when people come out to pitch a tent, where do you pitch a tent when it's steep?
We're trying to make some legends and stuff like that. And Joe just oversaw a major installation. We put in, what, about a 1 acre of parking and camping area?
Yeah. Parking, camping, RV, and recreation.
Yeah. We've been doing that, too. We've put in a flat spot for parking. And then in the last couple of weeks, we've been putting in some spots where you put down tents up in the up by the volcano. So.
Yeah. Well,
all right.
So to me... To me, it's I don't care what the land looks like. I want to implement permaculture into it. So,
yeah.
And I think we can do that.
I agree. I just think we can be, like, for people out there that have land or are going to buy land, what Jeff Lawton would say would be water access structure. And if you're not quite vertical, right, it's a little bit easier to deal with those three elements.
Yeah.
Right. You might do access before you do water in that case. Because the roads, I mean, having a good road and land like that makes such an enormous difference. You have no road whatsoever, everything becomes extremely difficult. And the first thing you want to do is the road.
Well, and then people say, well, you put your roads on contour. Well, that's fine. But sooner or later, I've got to put a piece in to connect one contour to the other. And there's a lot of engineering in that elevation change on that road and a lot of maintenance to maintain a road like that. And the more movement you can get across a contour with roads, great. But sooner or later, you got to go up if you want to get up.
Well, that, and you're taking up so much acreage by doing a 1 or 2% sloped road. You got to really understand and utilize all the acreage you're going to be using for that road. So if you can multi-purpose it, that'd be the best way to go.
Okay.
But it takes up a lot of land.
So just real quick, Elijah Spring, this piece of property is in West Virginia, and it's 110 acres. we've covered the steep part. The fact that it's got the word spring in the name suggests that there could possibly be water running on the land.
There are a lot of springs on the land. There is one spring, which is called Elijah's Spring, and that goes into the story of Elijah. So when this homestead at Elijah Spring was first put in, the homesteaders built this 9x15 little house out of the wood on the land. And while they were living in that house while they were building the primary house. And they had a son who made it 8 days, and I believe he died of the rickets. But his name was Elijah. And his gravestone is at the very top of the property. We just redid the gravestone, the plaque. We did a really nice plaque for it. But at any rate, so that's why it's Elijah Spring, and it's a particular spring on the property that they drank water from while they were homesteading it, actually throughout their entire time homesteading it. So that was their lifeline was that spring. And their son, Elijah, died at 8 years old. Eight days old.
8 days old. Wow.
Yeah. So they named the spring after him. And when Kevin and Charlie took ownership of the farm, they decided to retain that name because changing that kind of would be, dare I say, evil with that being the story behind it.
Yeah, and one of the family members from there came and visited the farm just to see it, and that really cemented in that we need to keep this going in the family, at least the name for them.
Okay, so now the thing that you guys are wanting to talk about today is the project. The project at the moment, which is going to be the foundation for Perma Ethos, and as part of the project, you guys are looking for more people out there. Is that accurate? Did I remember correctly?
Yes. Yeah, we're looking for. Go ahead.
My favorite part of that is that when you go to look for good people, you come to the Paul Wheaton Show.
Yeah, and Joe can tell you the opportunities that are available, but I mean, we have one position in particular that is a paid position. It's paid plus housing, and it is designed for you to eventually go run another farm for us. I'll let Joe, you can explain the opportunities.
Sure. So we have a couple of opportunities. One is a tenant farmer. We have one available position for that. We currently have two tenants. And the other opportunities are the WOOPFERS, that's Worldwide Opportunities for Permaculture Farms, and the Element Partners. So the key one that we are one of the key positions is that tenant farmer. So the tenant farmer will come here to Elijah Spring and learn how to become a farm steward, which is what I'm currently doing at the farm. You will learn to run the farm, run the business aspect of that farm as well. And you'll learn that for 1 or 2 years, depending on how quickly you're able to pick it up. And then you will be taking over one of our next farms. And then you will also get tenants under you to train them to open up other farms. So right now is the key time to come into this position because we're in infrastructure mode. We're starting up this farm. And one of the big learning curves that a lot of people, especially workers, miss out on is that time frame when you're building the farm and the infrastructure and the swales and the getting everything in order. It's also one of the hardest times. So there is a lot of work, but it's the learning involved in that is huge, especially if you want to eventually start your own farm, to learn all of these things before you go out and make mistakes, or at least you won't be making as many mistakes.
And I think it puts people in a lot more of a realistic mode, because if you go to an established farm, especially somebody that's really bang on doing it right, like Joel Salatin, well, you think, okay, when I start a farm, it's going to be like this. No, when you start a farm, it's going to be a big empty field full of tangles and gnarls, or a big mountain full of trees, or whatever, but it ain't going to be a farm unless you buy an operating farm. And even if you do that, if you buy a farm today, you're probably going to buy either a conventional farm or a slightly less icky farm we call organic. But you're probably not going to go out and buy a permaculture farm. There's not a lot of them for sale, and I know once somebody builds one, they're not real hip on selling them. So if you want to learn the establishment phase, you need to go somewhere where that's happening. And I know that we're learning it's dramatically more difficult than you think it is in your head. And I'm sure you've learned that too, Paul. But it also, as you're doing it, you start realizing, well, it does work. And it does lead exactly where you think it leads. But if somebody actually wants to build that in their future, it would do them well to come to a place like what we're doing or what you're doing and learn about the trials of getting there.
So what?
Yeah, and
what's on this farm right now? So like before you guys got there.
As infrastructure?
What's that?
Okay, so before we got there, there was a house, a garage with a empty area above it for potential, you know, whatever. A barn, an old barn, a chicken coop, and a outhouse. And the outhouse is the old style, which just had a pipe that ran off the cliff into the creek. So, yeah. And there was also one pond, and that pond was fed by Elijah Spring. So
okay.
There's also oil wells on the property.
Ironic.
Is riddled with oil wells. Yep. And so they had, they called them roads. So I guess you could call them roads. They had roads to those oil wells, and that's what was on the property. It was stripped bare. 20 acres of it was stripped fairly bare, and they were using that for hay when they're feeding their livestock with that. And there was 15 cows on it. Not the owner's cows. They were just the neighbor's cows that they let graze on the property.
Okay.
And that was it. So this was not a farm in spirit, but not in function. So we've started with a semi-blank slate, I guess. It's like the Etch-a-Sketch that you shook 7 times and you needed to shake it 9 times to make it blank.
Okay. So there's kind of, there wasn't a whole lot going on. It's mostly a little bit of farm-like stuff, but kind of for the decoration of it.
Correct. And it was, I mean, it was a farm at one time. I'm still not clear as to when exactly it was operational. When I walked the property, I would say that if you asked me to place a age on most of the hardwoods, about 30 years of age, I would say most of the hardwood regrowth is about 30 years. Some of it's much older, but the majority is 25 to 30-year-old regrowth. And we're trying to only remove of that which is necessary to accomplish what we want to. And because, like, there is this bare spot of 18 acres where it was just stripped. And that's where most of the time the cattle were grazing from the neighbor. And so we're focusing our initial efforts there. And then we're actually putting the fencing in through another 40 acres, 39, 40 acres, across top ridge lines and things like that, that are less subject to erosion. Because our hope is not just to do cattle, but to, you know, do pigs that are being finished on oaks and things like that. And a lot of that, that's what's there. You know, a 30-year-old oak tree, you can build a building, but you can't build a 30-year-old oak tree or a 30-year-old hickory. Or there's even some old apples and pawpaws and things like that throughout the property.
Okay. So now on the thing about the tenant farmer, so you're also looking for woofers that are like woofers. But for the tenant farmer, that would be a paid position. And clearly a woofer is somebody who's going to show up and probably not have much in the way of skills. But your tenant farmer, do you have some expectations of skills?
Yeah, and we get apps for it, and we get to pick and choose, so that's kind of nice. But we do expect that you at least have a permaculture design certification. and then of course from there we build on, you know, who's got the most skills and who seems best fit for, and the mentality of it, who's best fit for the position.
You know, and I mean, what we're looking for right now, for instance, so one of our tenants is a guy who's just retired from the Marine Corps, over 20 years, and he retired as a master gunnery sergeant. So we've got somebody that's got structural, right? And then Joe, of course, as the overall chief of operations there, has a lot of structural experience from his military background and a ton of experience in permaculture. And then we brought in our second tenant farmer is someone that was more of a livestock guy. So we're at a point now where we need more help and more dedicated 100% on the job there every day help. And so that kind of puts us in a position where we might see somebody that, you know, if we were looking for the very first one, maybe that person wouldn't have been right. But now that we have kind of the structure to drop them into, that person might be right. At this point, we're looking for somebody with a good grasp of permaculture, a good understanding of ethics, the drive and desire to go forward, someone that I know that when I look at them, I can say, I can trust this person. That's probably the biggest thing for me personally. Solid work ethic. And what we really want is someone that says, I either want to run this farm and have Joe go pick another place to live in the world and run another farm, or I want to go to another place in the world and run a farm. We're looking not for somebody that just wants to kind of drop in and have a job. We're looking for somebody that wants to end up at a point where they're running and operating a farm and deriving the bulk of their income from that farm's revenue. So, I mean, we're talking about a position that's not hugely paid initially, but has the potential to become a very lucrative position as a farm manager.
Okay. And then on Whoopers, you know, we've got something similar here where it's like I didn't want to get too married to the term woofer, so we've come up with our own thing called Gappers, which is based on GAP, where GAP is goofy about permaculture.
Okay.
Probably a little different. There's not a worldwide aspect to it. It's just here. And but one of the things that we've done, one of the things that when going down the road of woofer-like road, is it seems like you have these long conversations with everybody who wants to come out, and then only about one in five actually show up. So
yeah.
What we've done is we've said, give us $100. And so then these people give us $100. And if they never show up, that's fine.
with woofers or womfers, as we call them, we do have an application and we want to make sure you're not some psychopath, you know, that like you murdered 27 people or something like that. But pretty much our thing is show up, and we're not going to spend that much time screening that person, because if they show up and they suck, we're just going to send them home. And I don't think we've had much trouble with the work ethic, because we're drawing. I mean, if you're a freeloader, you're probably going to hate me and Joe already, so you're not going to come. I mean, just with the vibe we put out there, right? If you're like, I want to show up, man, and do yoga and like eat organic food and do no work, you're not coming anyway. I promise you that after one conversation, you'll be like, no, those dudes expect work. But at the other side of it, Joe actually put a cap on the work because the guys were working too much. You know, so they were
yeah,
by no choice
motivated.
Working too much, and then they were getting grumbly about it. So he's like, you got to stop at a certain point.
Yeah, we've been working our guys a little too hard too. But now on the form that you have, on the application that you just mentioned, and you got some concerns about psychopaths. So it's one of the questions, are you a psychopath? You know, do you have like yes
no,
or no? Put in yes or no. And then you said,
the
no, you're looking
is,
for people who haven't killed 27
okay?
people. So it's like, you have a question on there. How many people have you killed?
No, Joe has a very good psychopath detector, so he makes the if it doesn't matter what I say, if Joe doesn't think you're good to come to the farm, you're not coming. Joe is the final gateway for anybody that ends up on that farm.
Okay, all right. Well, I think that our $100 thing has been working out really well.
I like it. We might steal it.
Okay, yeah. Well, I actually
charge $101 so we can be one better than you.
Okay, all right. Well,
but we'll donate the $1 to the Paul Wheaton Fund.
we'll save up all the $1.
My idea. Actually, I stole the idea. I stole the idea from the Bullock brothers. So the guy that managed that, what he would do is that he worked all warm season at the Bullock brothers, and then 1 year he spent a winter with me in my house in the Seattle area. This is like, I don't know, 10 years ago or something. And so I heard about this system and he talked about it. And so basically, I don't think, I don't think it was the application. For me, for what we do here, it's a bit of an application. But for there, I think you had to pay $300. If you say you're going to show up, it's like they don't believe you until you send $300.
Okay.
Kind of a thing. So I kind of stole from that a little bit. But the problem we were having is that people wanted to ask, you know, legitimate questions. Like, can I bring my cat? And before you can really understand my question, I have to tell you the story of my cat. And it's like it turns out to be this long, you end up putting in hours visiting with somebody before they actually come out. Then it's kind of like, okay, are you going to pick them up at the airport? And then when you go to pick them up at the airport, once you get there, do they then call you to say, my flight's been canceled and I'm going to be coming 5 hours later? You know? And those kinds of things. And it's kind of like, okay, if it's $100, if they've paid in $100, we kind of don't care if, you know, for all that, it's like not that big of a deal. But if you haven't paid $100, it's like, then the only thing we want to talk to you about is where's the $100?
Yeah.
You know?
I don't think that's a terrible idea, honestly. I mean, Joe and his crew are doing a great job of providing a wonderful environment. And I don't know, maybe people actually would value something a bit more if they had to pay for it. You know, our view is we have people that come there, and the people who have come there so far have worked really, really hard. I don't know. We're spitballing here, and we have a whole board of ownership that all decisions have to be made by unanimous consent. But, you know, I'm kind of thinking, like, we would charge you $100, and if we think you did a really good job when you're done, we'll give it back to you. You know, and if you don't show up, we keep it, or if you suck, we keep it. And if you get your $100 back, it's stapled to a letter of recommendation to the next location if you get it back. And don't ask for a letter if you didn't get your money back, maybe. I don't know. But I'm thinking out loud here. But I like what you're doing, Paul, because that does say, you know, you're serious about it. You can barely stay in a flea bag motel for a night for $100. I mean, I don't stay in flea bag motels, but the last place I stayed was like a Holiday Inn Express. I think it was $139 for one night.
Yeah,
so $100 to come stay for a few weeks at like a full on permaculture farm, I don't think that's excessive at all.
Yeah, what we've been doing is we've been saying if you're going to come by for an hour, or if you're going to come by for the rest of your life, or if you're going to never show up, it's all the same, $100.
I see.
I mean, this kind of comes from my background in the corporate world, where we had contract workers, which were temporary, and we had permanent employees. And it's kind of like, you know, it never really mattered. If you're a contract worker and you show up and you do a good job and you earn your keep, they keep you around for years. But
yep.
If you're a permanent employee and you show up and you're lame, you're out the door in just a couple of days.
Unless
so
there's a union.
there is that. But in the world of professionals, which is what I was working in, then,
yeah.
You know, that was what my experience was. And so I kind of feel the same way, because we have people who pay up the $100 and then their life changes and shifts after we've talked to them and put all this time into them. And it's like, no big deal. No problem. Don't worry about it. We got the $100. It's all good. So it's fine. This has been – now we don't – because last year we had a lot of people that were like – we tried to say something like, okay, if you've listened to all the podcasts, come out for 3 or more days. And then we had people where by all it was like 20. And by 3 days what they really meant was 2 days. And by 2 days what they mean – is a day. And by a day, what they mean is not quite a day.
I flip this around and ask you a question then? Kind of look for people to spend like at least a week or two. How do you get much work out of a person that's there for a day?
That was the problem.
I see. Okay.
It's like, okay, Paul, I know you're supposed to be a busy guy and everything, but I'm here now. You got to stop everything. And I don't want the tour from that guy over there. I want
see.
To hear from you. Show me. And so then, you know, then we would try and set him up with a simple task like peeling logs. And it's like, I got to tell you, I don't know if you guys have ever peeled a log before, but about 20 minutes into it, it's like, you know what? I think I've now learned everything I ever need to know for the rest of my life. And I got to tell you that this so far doesn't have a lot of sex appeal. I think I'm ready to be done now after 20 minutes. But what, you know, what we had was we had some people that would come by. And, you know, on the other hand, we also had some people that came by for one day and they totally kicked ass. It's like,
really?
It was amazing. You know, they just tucked right into work and they're like, give me more. And they're like having a great time. There's people who show up and it's like they want to experience what we're doing. And they just jump right in and they have a great time. Where do you want me to go? What do you want me to do? And they'll do anything. And they're just, I don't know. It's like, you know, I could go to the gym or I could peel some fucking logs. I don't know. They really grooved on it. And there's other people that were like, I wanted to kind of see all the food you're growing and I'm going to judge it so that way I can write about it on my blog, which only three people see. And
yeah.
So, you know, and it's like, yeah, well then leave. Okay.
You haven't had any problems with anybody up there that way, Joe.
No, not at all. No, we've
okay.
All our guys have been really hard workers. We've gotten the weekend warriors, but they've all worked really hard, so that's been great. We've had overall a great experience with our roofers at least so far.
So for anybody that's listened to like 90% or more of my podcasts, 100% success.
Mm.
Anybody that's a Mormon, 100% success.
I believe that. That's why I'm laughing.
Yeah. So now we've had some people out here that have listened to 5 podcasts, 10 podcasts that have been great, and but we've also had quite a few that have like been not great. Last year we were trying to prepare for our workshops, and we hired people off of Craigslist, and we will never do that again.
Oh no,
that was a drama.
I was with
festival.
You until you said the word Craigslist.
Yeah. Oh, jeez.
No. No, I mean, with our workshops we've done at my property, my personal property here in Texas, we've always hired staff and we pay people, but we've hired them out of the survival podcast community. So I've said, you know, we need some people, contact me if you'd like to come out here and work. And we're very clear about what being a staff member, and we will do the same thing with PermaEthos. A staff member at a workshop does not mean you get to come to the workshop for free for doing dishes. It means if you happen to learn something from the workshop, excellent. If you get to hang out with people, excellent. But you're reporting to, in this case, you know, my wife or when Joe was here, Joe, and you're doing work. And when work is done, then you can do your own thing. And here's your money for that. But we do not do the whole, you can come for free, you know, and basically take the trash out and do the dishes and be part of the workshop. We hire dedicated staff because that's what it takes to handle a group of 20, 30, 40 people that have paid good money to come learn and expect to be fed and have the logistics handled and things like that. And yeah, Craigslist, and then no again.
We've done some work trade here that worked out really, really well, but it turns out that I think the reason why it worked well is because I'm such a dick.
I see.
I think, you know, there's some people are like, oh, work trade, and they're thinking exactly what you're talking about.
Yeah.
Like, I'm going to pay for this workshop with weak-ass promises of stuff that I'll do someday, which I will never do.
No.
And it's like, so here's what I've done is I said, okay, if you come and you work here on the farm for this many weeks, then you can take this workshop that's this many weeks.
Oh, I see. That's good. No, our staff has always been, they're here for the workshop, not they're here before the workshop. That might work for Joe up there, that might, we would see. But we've always looked at it personally here as, I need somebody to do this job. This job pays $100 a day. Here's your $100. Do your job or you're fired. And we've been really clear about that. So it's like, well, so-and-so's presenting right now and I want to go see it. Well, you're not here as a student.
right? Yeah. And because we've been that way up front, we've never actually had to have that conversation, right?
Yeah.
The people we've had have been unreal, exceptional. We have one couple, Michael and Teresa. They've worked the last three for us, and they're local, and they're right out of the TSP community. And they're just phenomenal. They just take care of so much. They're great. We have another gal named Sandy. She's worked for us on staff for two. She comes in from California. We pay her a rate, but we do not pay her plane ticket or anything like that. It's because she wants to be here for it. So she does want to be here for the event, but she understands, like, okay, here's your wage. Do your job. And that's worked out best for us. Is like, I just think if I want you to do something, Paul, and it's a job, it's a true function that has a time that you start, a time that you stop, and certain tasks that need to be done. If I value you, the greatest way for me to show you that is say, this is how much this value is, here it is, that's your money, now do your work.
So I'm going to say that for the work trade scenarios, we've had 100% luck so far. Where
great.
People show up on time, they do awesome work, and then they go to the workshop. Trade is complete. Everybody's happy.
But in your example, Paul, you're not hiring them to work the workshop. You're having them do other work in lieu of payment for the workshop.
Yeah.
And what I'm talking about is staff for the workshop to cater to the students who paid to come to the workshop. That's a little different. I like that idea, though. Like I said, that – if you have a farm like Joe's got that he's managing, that might work. I've got 3 acres here in Texas. I don't really, come here and work for 2 days. I might have something or I might not. Like, if you go see Joe, I guarantee you he's got something for you to do every minute of the day if that's what you want.
Yeah, yeah. So it's a wonky space, and we've had last year we had some drama. This year there's been some, but it's been like, 10,000 times smaller than last year. So it's everything's been so much smoother this year. But that's us.
Yep.
That's us. We're talking about you guys.
Yeah, because we got something else to talk about, man. We want to tell you about the opportunity to become an Element partner.
Okay, tell me what an Element partner is. Oh, wait, I think I know. Okay, but you guys tell it.
I'll let Jack take it. Go ahead, Jack.
I was going to let you take it because you created the word.
All right, fine. So an element partner is a person that finds an element on the farm and wants to work that element. So basically you're creating a business on the farm, and you take ownership of that business. We help you get it established, but you're submitting a business plan. And that business plan can include us helping you to get it established with a payback. But that's essentially what the element partner is. We also have remote element partners, but you can go forward with that.
Yeah, I mean, the remote element partner is something we're going to be rolling out, and it involves completing our educational program and then being certified for certain things that you're doing it right. So, like, our first two are probably going to be as a remote element partner to be able to sell honey and bee product under the Perma Ethos brand. And that'll be people that have completed Michael Jordan, his bee course that we'll be putting together and releasing probably either late winter, early spring. And then we're also going to be working with people as remote element partners from a standpoint of a small nursery type of environment, where one of our other partners, Nick Ferguson, who's been in the horticulture world for about 20 years now, will be developing a course for that. And that's the remote element partnership. The conventional element partner that Joe's talking about, though, is where you'd actually, at this point, come to Elijah Spring and develop your business there. In the future, maybe one of our other farms. So, for instance, our first element partner that we've kind of made the agreement with is Michael Jordan, the bee guy. And he's going to bring bees and hives and everything and set them up on the Perma Ethos farm. He's going to sell honey under the Elijah Spring and Perma Ethos umbrella. He's working to develop a relationship with a local vendor to develop a mead to sell from the product that he's producing. And that whole business unit, he'll take the lion's share of it, and Perma Ethos will take a component of it.
as a percentage for backing it, helping him get it set it up, doing his marketing, helping him develop the local marketing channels and things like that. So what I want you to think about, Paul, is how many times you've seen on your forum, permies.com, which, by the way, is the most awesome permaculture forum there is. I know that you'll now, like, put a feather in your cap and repeat that Jack Spirko said that, because that's what you do, the Duke of Permaculture. But it really is. Like, every time I'm looking for information on something in permaculture, damned if there's not a permies.com thread in the top 10 on Google. But what I've seen a lot of is, I want to do this, and I could do all of these things if I only had access to land. Okay,
right.
Here's land. Bring your butt up here. Take a couple weeks and volunteer work to make sure this is what you really want. Examine what's going on. Determine what you can do. Put real numbers behind it. Come to us with those, and we will figure out how to make sure you have a place to live and make sure you can feed yourself and get your business off the ground, and we'll put you on a pathway, and we expect in a certain timeline, some may be shorter than others depending on what the element is, that you're going to get up and fly all by yourself, and you're going to develop your own revenue streams with our help and support. I don't know of anything like that in permaculture anywhere that exists that way. Even if you look at what Joel Salatin is doing with fiefdoms, it's pretty much like, okay, yeah, here's some land, go. It's not, okay, what do you need? And then the response, our response to that is, okay, fine, show us the ROI. Show us the plan, show us the numbers, and if it's doable under our current budget, we'll fund it if we think you're a good bet. And I don't think there's a lot of opportunity out there like that right now.
Yeah, I agree. And I was going to ask, like, how does this compare to Joel Salatin's fiefdoms? And it sounds,
well, there,
like,
you go.
Oh, it's the same.
It's the same, but different, man.
My pod people are familiar with that one, but now yours is going to be different because you're going to want to see a business plan. Is that right? Yours
Correct.
Is different from Joel Salatin's fiefdoms.
It doesn't have to be an 80-page full SWOT analysis on the marketing side business plan, but it does have to be like, okay, let's use bees for an example, because I'm familiar enough with that to lay out some examples, that if I had 50 hives, each hive on a low end should be able to produce 100 pounds of honey. So there's, you know, 5,000 pounds of honey. Going market rate is this. Cost of setup is that. Additional peripheral products are this. Opportunities for splitting out, developing nukes, and selling those is why. And a basic understanding of what the numbers are. Because if a person just says, well, I want to do an egg mobile and do pastured poultry for eggs. Okay, how many chickens? What's the going rate of a dozen eggs that are pastured this way? You know, so it doesn't even mean that we won't help you develop it. We'll help you develop the plan. We're not just like, bring us a plan or go away. You're icky and we do not want you. It's not like that, but there has to be some thought process behind it, because one of the things I've seen in permaculture, and I don't want to bend anybody's nose the wrong way here or anything, but this, like, they watch a bunch of YouTube videos or whatever, and they're like, oh, it's easy, and I'll just do this, and there'll be money, and everything will be wonderful, and unicorns will come and fart rainbows, and I will ride my rainbow down, and I will get money, and it will be great, and I will have abundance and surplus to share. And no, we want to see the mindset of, this is a business, this is the numbers behind the business, this is where I would locate it on the property, this is why I've chosen that location. And I think that, again, it's not like if you don't bring us an 80-page proposal that you would bring to a venture capitalist, we don't want to talk to you. But it is like that thought process has to be there. And, you know, we're going to sanity check your numbers and make sure they make sense. And it's also going to have to be something that we can envision existing on our farm. If you come to us and say, we want to raise chinchillas for fur, we're probably going to say, yeah, we're not really interested.
All right, I want to insert my obnoxious and unasked for opinion.
Okay.
Okay. First, I think that anybody that's going to come to this project is going to be familiar with your stuff.
Yeah.
And I seriously don't think they're going to be into unicorns and farting rainbows. I think that they're already going to have they're all going to be pretty solid. And I also think the same of my audience. I don't think you're going to find anybody in my audience that's going to be, and this is, I call them the purple crowd. And I believe I'm – I got to – every time I say that, I got to qualify it by saying, I think I've got a fair bit of purple in me. But and at the same time, I'm a very harsh businessman. But
exactly.
But here's where I've got my obnoxious opinion, and that is that I'm going to say I'm going to raise chinchillas and I'm going to try and make some money out of it. And you're going to say, oh, yeah? How much money are you going to make? And my answer to you is, none of your fucking business, Jack. Look,
good, then
wanna,
do it by yourself.
I want to overlay this. I want to be on the land. I want to be able to do this. And then it's like, you know what? But I'm the one gambling here. I'm going to gamble. I'm going to invest 10 grand into chinchillas. And I've got some ideas on how it's going to work out. But, you know, it might not work out. And I'm going to go bust. But I want to take the gamble. Now, what I need to know from you, Jack, is like, how much do you need from me for the level of impact I'm looking to doing? And I mean, like, what do I need to do to tell you, like, how I'm not going to screw everything up on your land and that kind of thing?
I have to say that at that point, I would say, since we don't want a chinchilla operation, I don't really care. I mean, just completely honest with you. But I get the point that you're making, and my point is that I'm stepping into this and my partners are stepping into this at least equal risk share, because we're providing you a place. If you show us a good opportunity, we're providing you initial funding. We're providing you a marketing channel. We're providing you support from the rest of the community to get your operation up and running. We're not asking you to show up and do it all by yourself. And if that's not good enough, then why are we talking? Because that wasn't the invitation.
No, I guess my feeling is, like for example, my brother is currently running cattle and hogs up on the laboratory.
Okay.
And it's kind of like, so he and I talked about it a little bit. But I don't feel it's my business to get involved in how much he sells them for. And in fact, I would imagine that market is going to shift from point to point, and that's really his affair. And I kind of feel like I don't want to be involved in that. So I don't, and granted, while I'm supplying land, he's supplying labor and materials, and he's taking the biggest risks. But at the same time, what I did say was, is that I do have requirements about how animals are on my land, and they need to move at least this often. And they, you know, I don't want to see the ground whittled down this much and things of that nature. I have requirements. I have things
sure.
that are within my comfort zone for
sure.
how
and
this
so,
operation
and
goes.
So would we, but I'll put it to you a completely different way. PermaEthos was launched, and in a week did $450,000 worth of revenue
right.
in a week, okay? It's a brand new company due in large part to a massive amount of social capital that have been developed by myself and Josiah. And what we are offering is not just a piece of land to run cattle on, because if you want that, you can lease land cheap anywhere and go do that.
Right.
We are offering the willingness to market your product to our market. And if that ain't good enough, I bless you and kiss you on the forehead, and may you be fruitful and multiply cattle or bees or what chinchillas or whatever it is until you are blue in the face and be successful and make millions of dollars. But go do it somewhere else. Because it's not you taking the biggest risk. It's us taking the biggest risk, because we're installing you on a property with one of our clients who we have a responsibility to. It's not just the Joe and Jack utopia, libtopia, right? This is a client-based farm run for profit at the behest of a client. And if you don't get that, then raise chinchillas in your basement.
Okay. So it sounds like part of what's going to be required for people that are going to be doing being an element partner.
And let me clear one thing up before you go on, like, because you're talking about, like, the price of cattle. It's true. We don't know what your cow's going to sell for, but we do know a basic market value of cattle, okay? That there's a certain baseline to a reasonable expectation for a grass-fed and grass-finished cow of average weight raised in this ecosystem. And we know there's a basic value to that. And if your input requirement is $80,000 to get something off the going and running off the beginning, just to be obscene, that's going to run five cattle, okay, then the ROI is not there. So it's not about sharpening the pencil down to the final penny. It's about, does your plan make financial sense, since we're willing to step up as a financial partner in it, just the same way a bank would ask you, only we'd be probably far more lenient than a bank. But if if your numbers just don't make sense, right? Well, I'm going to do this. I'm going to grow cucumbers. Okay, great. And you're going to grow 10 bushels of cucumbers. I can't afford for you to be there for 10 bushels of cucumbers. I'm sorry, the market doesn't bear it, if that makes sense.
And it's also a big element sync. So you need to make sure that your element will sync with the rest of the elements, and those elements will sync well with your element. So
you might want to do something we're not ready for yet, right? Yeah. I mean, if somebody came to you right now, Joe, and said, I want to raise trout, you'd say, that's a fabulous idea. Come see me in a couple of years. Because we're just we can't do that right now. We're not anywhere near the place where we could add that element to what we're doing right now.
So now, I thought that the cool thing about when Joel Salatin talks about fiefdoms is it's like, okay, I've got on any piece of land right now, like the one with the most fiefdoms might have like 12 fiefdoms right now. But it's like there's room for 70. And out of those 70, I've got guesses on what, you know, 15 of those might be, but the rest of them, like, I've never even thought of yet.
Correct.
And so the land could probably hold even more than 70. It's this thing where it's like the overlaying, and then each time a new project is overlaid, oftentimes that new project that's overlaid receives benefit from the other fiefdoms, and then the new fiefdom also add some small benefit to some of the other fiefdoms. Just
and that's revenue between the two elements.
Exactly, and that's all good and well, but just to like to explain the sanity check here, because remember, Joel is a public speaker speaking in public and making things sound simple, but one of the things he was clear on out of Permaculture Voice is if somebody came to me and said, we want to raise 50,000 broilers, he said, I'd have to say no because I can't sell 50,000 broilers. So even there are certain limitations based on what will our individual market umbrella bear. And again, does your numbers make sense? Right? So we're all about that. In fact, one of the requirements Joe has of his people, as you get toward the end of your rotation, he wants like 10 ideas from you. What could you do to make money here? What could you do? Even if they don't want to do it, that's part of your payment to us, is you've been there this long. If I said to you right now, you've lost your job, there's nowhere to go but here, you can't go home, make something happen. What would you do? Because we want that intel from people, because they will see things you won't see.
I like that. I think we should put that on our little question.
I think you should. Like you should hold them at gunpoint. I know you don't have a gun, but your brother does. And be like, you can't be giving us five ideas for revenue.
I like that. I mean, if nothing else, I like the idea of saying like, okay, you're coming here as a gapper or whatever, and so like, let's say, you know, you're going to be here for the next 20 years. What might you do for income? Although, you know, I got to take that back. Now I'm changing my mind about this because I feel like some people, they're not sure what they want to do. But they know that what they're doing is not it, and what we're doing smells like it. Smells like this is where I'm supposed to be.
Let me tell you on that though, Paul. Like part of the reason you pressure people to do this is to get them unstuck and get because. People have this fear like if I say an idea is a good idea, then I'm stuck with it. I have to do it. No, you don't. You have to get it out. So when you look at people that go to a typical landscape design college degree, do you know what they call the trace paper that you put over the main print where you do all your ideas and schematics, what they teach you to call that piece of paper?
Onion paper.
Trash. To get in the mindset that what you draw there, that's why it's trace paper. It doesn't matter. You've got to get the idea out, because if you don't let it out, it won't evolve. What the hell?
That's Josiah, man.
That's Joe, man. He's like running down truckers or something. But anyway, if you don't get the idea out, it won't evolve into anything. So I've always pressured interns, employees, et cetera, tell me what you think. And a lot of times there's like this fear, like, you're going to say that idea is stupid. And I'm like, I might say it's stupid, and you might prove me wrong. Because as soon as the mind engages the idea, it starts to connect dots that were never connected before. So I will absolutely push somebody to spit out an idea, even if it's dumb, because three dumb ideas might lead to one brilliant idea.
True.
Where is he going?
I think he's under arrest.
I'm not going
now.
Anywhere.
I hear sirens now.
That's the holler.
So, all right. Let's. I mean, there's gobs and gobs of things that I want to say right now that's about what I'm doing that's different than what you're saying, but I think we're trying to focus on permit ethos on this show instead of what I'm doing.
Yes.
And I think my listeners already know what I'm doing.
Yes.
And so, the Element Partner, much like Joel Salatin's Fiefdom program, only, you know, you're going to have a business plan, and it'll need to, and of course, with Joel
and
Salatin.
And before you say that, you're not going to Joel's farm, saying you have an idea, and setting up a fiefdom on any of Joel's farms without a business plan. I don't know where you pulled that idea out of. But after talking to him, I can tell you absolutely, if you don't have some concrete idea of numbers. Now, it might be really easy if you're doing an internal fiefdom. So, like, if you were setting up a market garden, and like one of these things you set up where the guy basically sold the food to Polyface for Polyface use, it might be easier. But Joel is not letting you set up a fiefdom without a plan. It's not happening.
Oh, no. You got to have some kind of rough plan. And then it's got to... Your plan's got to include what are you giving to Joel as part
Correct.
Of the plan?
Correct.
You know, I just kind of am feeling a little bit like when I've talked to Joel, about this idea, about this thing, it sounds more like there's a simple conversation that's not a plan, and then afterwards, after the conversation, you're going to have I think he calls it a memorandum of understanding.
It's genius.
It's basically about the relationship between the two people.
Yeah.
And how it's going to work out. I don't get the idea that it's a formal business plan. It's more like, whereas with Perma Ethos, it sounds like it's a document that's going to go in front of a lot of different people.
In front of five people. And possibly our board of advisors, possibly depending on things. And it also depends on who's bringing it, how much information we're going to require. Michael Jordan, who makes his living from bees and has an existing bee business and says, I can do this and bring more here, the bridge is a little, you know, easier to cross because you've got a proven track record. Some guy we've never heard of before that decides he wants to put in a Cornelian cherry orchard. Well, we're going to know how you're going to develop that market. We can help you with it, but we're going to need quite a bit of information about how you're going to develop that market. Because there's not a big existing market for Cornelian cherries. I think they're a great fruit, but we're going to have to think about that. And we're going to have to look at that. So don't let the word business plan, again, I said this, like I said, I'm not saying an 80-page, you know, document like you'd go to a VC with. You have to have a basic understanding of the market you're entering, what the basic market will bear, what possible premium you could come up with, what possible level of production you could do with what you're asking us to provide you, how much money you need to get it going. And frankly, I'd say to anybody that thinks that's too much, good luck on your own.
Yeah, no. And once again, I want to insert my obnoxious, unasked-for opinion. And that would be that to say that, you know, it should fit on one page.
I would actually tell you that the person that brought me a one-page plan that actually gave me what I'm asking for would go to the front of the line. I've always been on the one-page. The guy that – I don't like some things that he did because he's in government. I hate government. But the guy that I took that philosophy from is Ronald Reagan. The one-page memo. You should be able to take any concept, idea, or decision and define everything that's actually important on one page. and enough for me to make a decision on one page. So when I say business plan, it may fit on one page. You might throw a spreadsheet in with it to show me you've done some market analysis, but I should be able to get the gist of what you're saying. I actually really like that. But a lot of people would struggle, Paul, that actually did all the research to go down to that level of condensing, and I wouldn't throw them out because they brought me 5 pages or 10.
So I want to now continue where I was going about 5 minutes ago, and then you're going to tell me, like, yes, we're going to do that also, or we're going to do a different thing. And that is that with Joel Salatin saying, my understanding is that everybody that's coming to him and saying, I want to do a fiefdom deal, is somebody who's already spent probably at least 6 months there working with Joel. And so he's got some history there. And at some point in time, it sounds like Joel's kind of like he wants you to transition into a fiefdom.
Mm-hmm.
And so at some point in time, you're kind of – it's kind of expected. You got to figure out what your fiefdom's going to be.
Yeah. Joe can say more on that after he gets out of his tunnel or whatever. But, I mean, we look at it this way. Like our tenant farmers, as we call them, they're not a real – I mean, a tenant farmer from the Middle Ages was you leased a piece of land from a monastery or something and you farmed it, and you either succeeded or you failed. They're not that way. I mean, we're paying them a salary of about $1,000 a month, and we're providing them housing, and we're providing them meals. But we are looking for them to, again, either step up to a position where we feel like they can move to another farm and run it, doing Joe's job on that farm, or for them to say, you know what, running the whole farm, not my thing. I want to do cattle, or I want to do pigs and cattle, or I want to do bees, or I want to do whatever it is and move into that element partner position. With Wamfers, we're constantly prodding them. What could you do? What could you do? But we will take somebody that comes to us and says, I want to do this, if they don't have a real track record there. We would absolutely require that they spend some time on the farm working the farm.
Okay.
And understand the environment and the conditions before we said yes. And in the end, since at Elijah Spring, Joe is the head farm steward, whether you get in or not is going to be his decision because that's his farm that he's running. So in the end, Joe's going to be the one that makes that call whether or not we would install you there. Now, say 2 years down the line, I've got 4 farms. Well, now I've got 4 Joes. I can't ever really have another Joe, but I got 4 other guys doing Joe's gig. They would make that call on the farm that they're running. And every element partner has the potential eventually to say, well, I want to move beyond this and move up to there. So we have a very multifaceted opportunity in front of people. It's not just one farm or 4 farms in one state. You know, we're looking to do this thing nationally. We've got the horsepower behind us to make that happen now. So, I mean, that's kind of thing. But, yeah, I don't think that we would ever hire somebody that's never been there as an element partner.
Okay.
But 6 months we might not require either. If you got a guy that comes in, kicks ass and takes name for 30 days and goes, I can do this, gives us a plan, and says, let's get going, and we believe that plan is actionable, you know, we'll back it. But in the end, again, Joe's got the final veto on that because it's his farm.
Okay. So, next one, the next item I've got on my list of things to talk about is that you've got some courses or workshops coming up. Is that true?
Yeah.
I mean, I've got down here something about plants and another thing that's kind of similar with bees, a mentorship. Do I have this right?
Yeah, in Farm Ethos, we have two educational sections we focus on. One is the online educational section, and one is the on-site educational section. So the on-site workshops that we have coming up, we have a earthworks workshop, which is a massive earthworks workshop. We're connecting major swales in between ponds. We have 4 large ponds we're putting in, and 8 smaller ponds that are going on the 20-acre hill, first hillside of Elijah Spring. So that's the earthworks workshop we're doing. And then after that, we're going to be doing a fencing workshop. And the fencing workshop is 30,000 feet, or about 30 on about roughly 35 acres of fencing that we're putting in for paddock shift and laneway system. That's also going to be taught by Darby Simpson and myself. And so that workshop's coming up probably at the beginning of next year. The Earthworks workshop coming up in either the end of August, beginning of September. So those are the two big workshops coming up. We also have a plant propagation course coming up, and Jack can fill you in more on that.
Yeah, so one of our partners, Nicholas Ferguson, again, as I mentioned him before, he's been in the horticulture world for about 20 years, and he's in his 30s, so that tells you something about how young he was when he started. And we're working with him to develop a program for plant propagation and basically backyard nursery. And we see a lot of opportunity there for people to sell plants in their local communities, but also have access to the Perma Ethos brand because they're doing things the way that they were trained by us. And it's not just you sign up for the course, you take the course, you do that. There'll be tests and there'll be some evaluation to make sure that when we say this person's, you know, doing things and providing the quality that we're looking for, that we have an assurance there. And we'll have an opportunity for customers to offer reviews, you know, kind of like an Angie's List type of thing. And if somebody's getting like a bunch of crappy reviews, we'll revoke that. So it's not like just a permanent, you're stamped and, you know, you can do that. And then, as I mentioned, Michael Jordan also is developing the course with bees, so that we'll have people that can be remote element partners that way. And we've been approached with some other remote element partnership concepts with people developing courses in the herbal world and some other things. And we'll take things under, you know, consideration as we go. We do have to be careful not to go too far too fast, and to make sure that we're doing a good job so we can provide the type of customer service and follow-up that we're looking for. Joe is about to bring in a virtual assistant that actually will be on the farm for a week for some direct training to do customer service and things like that. We want to make sure that somebody's taking an online course. If they have questions, that question goes to the right place. A question gets answered in a reasonable amount of time. If they have a billing concern, I mean, the online component of this has almost as much work as the on-site component of this, not just from education, but from just daily operations. It's really amazing how big it's gotten as fast as it has, and we're very excited about that. But we're also at a point now where we're holding the throttle. We're not backing it off, but we're also not pushing it forward for a little bit until we make sure we can take care of everybody's needs.
I understand that. We're currently throttling back because everybody here is just exhausted from the big push. We've been here about a year, and it's like it's time to throttle back a little bit.
And Joe, how long have you been on site? Like 70 days or something like that?
Yeah, just over 2 months.
And it's amazing what they've gotten done. I mean, they've put in a parking lot, they've built housing. The chicken coop, I heard you kind of giggling, Paul, when Joe talked about converting that to housing. Dude, that place is awesome. I mean, it is a tiny house on steroids. And it's got a beautiful view of the creek. The creek is all rock bottom. Guys drive, you know, vehicles right down the creek without sinking because it's a solid rock bottom creek. It is absolutely outstanding. I don't think you could build it today because the type of timber it was built with, there's not much of it standing anymore. So you've got to understand the level of what they've done already is really kind of hard to comprehend, I think, in such a short period of time. And I think it's because we have gotten outstanding people in there to do work. Like I said, Joe got to a point where, like, they're all working 14-hour days, and then they're getting grumbly at the end of the day. And he's like, so I've got to, like, tell them, like, okay, you're done. You're done for the day. So our minimum workload that Joe has people to come there and be, you know, a volunteer worker and to be fed in house, we expect you to work a minimum of a 4-hour day. I don't think he's ever had anybody work a 4-hour day though.
No, in fact, one of our applications was 4 hours.
That's great.
Okay, so now
yeah,
people want.
We've gotten a lot more done too. Well, I mean, we also got. Three ponds in the lower fields done, and we also got two larger ponds put in, one of which feeds our entire livestock, the other 80 acres where all the livestock paddock shifting is going, with the baffle plate and every pipe, water pipe and baffle plate. And so we're almost finished with that final one, which is a valley top dam with a silt trap dam below it. Those have also been put in place already.
You know, I forgot to mention those additional ponds, Joe, and this is a great opportunity for people to understand what needs to be done at a business level for business decisions. So Joe gets in touch with me one day and says, we got a problem. And I'm like, what's the problem? He says, okay, we ordered these baffle plates for the dam so we can put penetrations in the dam walls without blowing them up and feed water with gravity to all our animals. I'm like, uh-huh, yeah, I know that. What's the problem? He's like, well, the people we ordered them from a week before the dam was installation began said they would have them to us in 7 days. We're now way past 7 days. All the guys from the excavation company are done with everything they can do until we have those baffle plates, and they're going to leave if we don't give them more work. Oh, crap. Well, what does that involve? So a couple things. Number one, they're going to charge us a $2,000 trip charge to come back here. Number two, they're a big company that does this stuff, and they kind of took us because we were in a hole in their labor pool, and we were ready to work with them and ready to pay them. But if they get on a big job, they might not be back here for 30 or 40 days. Oh, crap. And he's like, I can put them to work on this other section. They can do some clearing. They can put some roads in. They can do some access stuff. They can put some small ponds in. But they're going to cost us, I think it's like $2,800 a day. But they'll do whatever we want because it's an hourly rate. And we had to make a decision. Let's either get these people who are dragging their feet to get it done, and they didn't. We got two other partners working to find us a different solution to the baffle point problem, and one of them worked out. We put them to work for a couple days and paid the extra money, but we didn't burn the $2,000 on the trip fee, got the solution in, and then got that done. And when you hear me say things like business plan and that scares people, this is why it shouldn't. These are the real business decisions that cost real money that have to be made when you're developing the infrastructure, which is expensive, but if you do it right, you develop 100 years to 200 years to maybe 1,000 years worth of infrastructure in the first couple years. So it's worth putting the money into. And that was, you know, that's the type of thing that, you know, probably is going to end up in a PowerPoint deck someday, how we made that decision. But really the way we made it was me pacing back and forth in my front yard and Joe probably pacing back and forth in a pasture on a cell phone to each other. Like, we've got to figure out how to deal with this, because if we make the wrong call, it's not just going to cost us direct money. It's also going to cost us time, and it's going to cost us not being able to put water to our animals. So we had to pull all the partners together, get a consensus, and get that done. And we were able to do that in a couple hours because we were all thinking with a business head. It wasn't about any emotional thing like they should do that for us because they should share their surplus or some crap like that. It was, this is a nuts and bolts business decision that we have to make, and the people on the other side of us, they're not our enemy. They're our partners, but that equipment burns money if they're not running it, and they have every right to pull out if we don't have work for them to do. But it puts us in a bad situation, so how do we handle it? And if I'm telling you, if you want to go into permaculture to make your backyard look awesome, you can breathe all the purple you want, in your words, right? But if you want to make money on a farm, you have to have at least some level a cold, calculating business mind to go along with a very moral and ethical agenda and goal. And those two are not exclusive from each other. I know you know that, but I'm not sure everybody listening to us does.
Well, and this gets into that whole thing that you and I have spent hours arguing about on the phone when we're not recording a podcast about ethics. And I think that, anyway. I think that the techniques that we teach come with an ethics package, and it's like
Correct.
When you're implementing a lot of these techniques, you end up following the ethics without even trying. But then if you try to go ethics first, it's my philosophy that people have been debating ethics for millennia, and it's like and there's people that are doing some extremely unethical things saying that it's ethical. And that not only is it ethical, but it's the permaculture ethics. And it's kind of like, and then we could point at them and say, but that's not what was meant. And they're like, yes, it is. And it's like, oh, great. Now we've got one of these kinds of debates going on. You know, no, I'm not. You are too.
No, see, I don't do that. I'm like, call Bill and ask him. So since I've actually been able to ask that question, not directly to Bill, but the guy that I consider is his direct protege, and I've said, what would Bill say? And Jeff has said, Bill would say this. I'm like, we're done. We're done with that discussion. We're done talking about that. You can, and I'm not going to fight you about it. You can believe whatever you want, but you just go make your own fiefdom, and I'll stay in mine, and we'll work that out. And my belief is actually the ethics, and this is where we've had a debate, the ethics do come at the front, because if the ethics are actually practiced the way that they were defined, they actually develop the solutions for you. And one of the things that, and I have to say this here on online right now, because it may look a little bit like we compete with Jeff's online PDC or whatever. Jeff Lawton is my greatest mentor in all things. Jeff Lawton is a guy that when I met him, it was one of the proudest days of my life. And he has taught me so many things long before I ever even met him. And one of the things I learned from him is the more restrictions in a design, the more elegant the design becomes. And one of my proudest days when I was able to kind of flip that around on him and tell him, because he's always said, if you had like a blue sky budget, a great big square piece of land, the ability to do anything you want to it with it, it's actually difficult to design because you don't have enough restrictions to guide your creativity. And I said, well, in that situation, those three ethics are your initial restrictions, and that's what guides your creativity. And I believe that as long as we don't try to turn the third ethic into something it's not for political agendas, then that's exactly what it does. Because if I'm required to, you know, there's two ways that ethic's been expressed by the actual founder of the movement. One is to limit population and consumption, and the other one has been to return surplus. And they really are kind of the same thing. And if I have to build a farm with the fact that every single thing I produce in surplus is my problem, not somebody else's, then I'm going to develop a sustainable system, I'm going to care for the earth, and I'm going to care for people. And I think that as long as we don't bastardize that and try to turn it into some kind of political agenda, it actually is one of the greatest guides to design that there is. But it takes a certain amount of personal discipline to be able to do that. Because I have my own political agenda, right? Which is no politics, right? And everybody else has their own political agenda. And we always have this compulsion to draw our politics into something. But permaculture is about design, like architecture is. And if you go to architectural school, whether you are an atheist or a Catholic or a Protestant or Jewish or Hindu, and somebody says, can you design a church for me? Well, you can design a church based on architecture. And you don't have to let your religious baggage get in the way. So I can design an ecological system without letting my politics get in the way if I put the design first. And to me, I can do that ethically in a way that's universally ethically as long as I stay true to the core message. And that's why I think that those three little sentences are the brilliance that all of the design is based on. And that's why that crotchety old crazy man is one of the most awesome human beings that's ever walked the face of the earth.
So now I think that your expectation of the average human being is higher than mine.
Oh, no. My expectation is really low. My standard is very high. So I don't expect people to meet that standard, but I'm still willing to set that standard and say, if you want to play ball at this level, that's the standard. So how many people do you think, Paul, percentage-wise in this country, have the capability to play Major League Baseball?
Okay. First you got to know that I don't think I've seen a baseball game in okay. 10 years.
I don't care. Programmer, to play NFL football.
To have the ability to play professional baseball,
yeah,
I guess would be the exact number of positions there are for playing.
There you go. Okay, so it's a very low percentage, but we ain't lowering the bar. And the guy that plays minor league ball and does really, really well and never makes it there, that's the bar he's aiming. So I'm not bringing the standard down due to the inability of people to meet it.
See, I see it as like, how can I move permaculture as a whole forward? And then it's like, if I give people the three ethics to use as tools, then I see them using them in a less than ethical fashion or not making progress or turning it into a lifelong debate or something like that. Whereas it's like, I believe that the person is uncommon that will be able to take the three ethics and solve problems in a way that the three ethics were designed to solve.
But
I mean,
Paul, the one that does becomes a Jeff Lawton or a Sepp Holzer or a Paul Wheaton. You understand
okay, sure,
that?
Sure.
And that is worth it because that one creates thousands of minor leaguers and thousands of B leaguers and D leaguers and thousands of little leaguers and thousands of Pop Warner football players and thousands upon thousands upon thousands. But that one sets the expectation that I might not even be to that level myself, but that's what I aspire to, so that's what you should aspire to too.
I can hand a bow saw, a brand new high quality bow saw, to 10 different people and say, I need you to, there's trees over there and we need firewood over there. And within an hour, 9 out of 10 will have broken the bow saw.
Correct.
Okay. So, and the thing is that you are looking for that 1 out of 10 and I'm looking to get wood piled up. And I'm also wanting my tools to not get broken. And so I kind of...
Well, I give you your first blade, baby. You got to buy your own replacements and let's go make some wood. I mean, that's, you know, you get into a philosophical debate now. So I'm not going to ever tell... Let me make sure I explain this correctly. I'm not going to ever tell somebody, you, sir, are not a true permaculturist because you have changed the ethics. I'm going to say you're wrong about the ethic. Good on with everything else you're doing. Keep going. Right. But when I teach, I'm going to teach from the original design concepts as I understand them based on the direct information I have from the people that have direct access to that information. Right. So when I say, am I wrong about this? And I have a guy like Lawton tell me, oh, no, you're not wrong at all. That's exactly what Bill would tell you. Well, then that's what I'm going to teach.
Yeah. I think, and this is the exact same argument that you and I have for hours and hours and hours every time we have this argument, and it's like, we're seeking different things. Yes, teach the ethics. That is good and right and decent. At the same time, I'm struggling with people that have not taken the PDC and they've read the three ethics, but not the explanation that goes with it. And they're committing crime in the name of the third ethic.
Yeah, well, understand, I spend 98% of my time on technique and 2% on philosophy here. We're talking about this because you brought it up. The latest video series I'm doing is how to propagate comfrey, how to make fertilizer from comfrey. And you can have any freaking ethereal, political, or religious belief you want, and that still works the same way. So we want the same thing. I'm just unwilling to shelve something that I think will make some people exceptional. And one of the things you said about the work that we're doing here at Permaculture Voices is we're reaching people that the conventional people in permaculture are not reaching. And we're reaching them precisely because we refuse to breathe purple. And we specifically state things that are so clear to the average person that it does make sense to them. And when they look at this thing and they see some video of a bunch of people rolling around in mud or something like that, and they think that's what permaculture is, and they hear someone like myself or Joe speak entirely different about it, they say to themselves, maybe this is something for me. And that's why we're able to reach those people. Instead of preaching to the converted, we're preaching to the heathens. And we're reaching the heathens because they're not really heathens. They're just people that don't understand what this is really about. And that's why we have the broad reach that we have. That's why we can do something like raise, $400,000 for permaculture in a week. We can do that because we're not parroting pablum. We're speaking the core truth. And I am not a religious man, but ye shall know the truth, and the truth shall set you free.
There's a there's a quote Bill Mollison made was there's no room for politics, religion, or law in permaculture. And I like that.
Yeah.
I completely agree. I completely agree.
My last bit on the ethics is that I have this set of experiences with managing my forums about permaculture. And so I get to have lots of encounters with lots of different people, and then we need to solve the problems, as well as there's the actual content of the forums where we're talking about different permaculture things. And I think I've got some track record for putting out a very practical perspective on permaculture. And so it's been my experience that when the ethics come up, it's like, to me, in my mind, a big red flag goes up. Like, oh, shit, here we go.
You know what's crazy, Paul? Until I met you, I didn't even know anybody changed the third ethic. I didn't even know that existed. I had no idea. I swear to God, I had lectured at multiple PDCs as guest instructors. I had helped teach workshops. I had been to workshops. I'd talked to permaculture people my whole life. But I was working in a space of let's get shit done. And I actually think the people that you think are a problem are 1%, but they're a noisy-ass 1%, and I just don't have time for them.
Yeah.
Oh, I just don't. I'm not going to alter what I teach for 1%. I'm going to dedicate myself to the 98-99% that are here to learn the things that work. And
all I'm trying to say is my experience is that when the ethics are brought up, it's not to be used as a tool for good. And it's like, so now I've been trained to be skittish, spooked.
Yeah.
It's like,
Well, in your defense, you've had some people do some really stupid crap claiming the ethics, like taking somebody's copyrighted material, scanning it, and distributing it for free, even though the person that wrote it said, dude, I'm not cool with that. This is how I make my living. And they go, I'm sharing the surplus, dude. Okay, that person's a problem, but I'm not catering to that person.
I don't have time to argue the ethics with someone, but I do have time to prove them wrong.
Beautiful, Joe.
Yeah.
Beautiful. Yeah. That's why we're partners right there.
Okay.
And I'll tell you what, Joe can take a dyed-in-the-wool Republican and beat them down in one night into anarchy. I've seen it done. I've seen it done. It's great.
Oh, my.
And it's
everybody's
more impressive when you do it to Republicans than Democrats. It's really impressive. When a guy just finally goes, I quit. I'm done. I have nothing else. Fine. There shouldn't be any government. That's awesome.
Okay, so now if a person wants to learn about the tenant farmer position, the whoopers positions, or about being an element partner, or maybe just to see pictures of what you're doing and things like that, and to learn about the Perma Ethos upcoming PDC, which will probably not be available for purchase again until next spring, to get any of this information, and I'm sure so much more, where do you go?
You go to permaethos.com, and also check out the Perma Ethos community.
And okay. You didn't ask us about, like, one of the most incredible, earth-shaking, groundbreaking things that we're going to be doing this year.
I've got it on my list, and I wanted to get to that right after saying that. And so I said that. Oh, hey, Jack, I've got a note on my list here about something called Perma Ethos TV.
Correct. So part of what makes our PDC different is that we have this bona fide Hollywood producer doing all the work and using things like remote control aerial drones to do flyovers of land contours and things like that. And since he's living on the property and doing this, we cut a deal with him to where not only is he shooting and filming and doing the PDC for his fee, that we would put him into a position as – honestly, I guess Kelly really, Joe, if you think about it, is our first true element partner. With a percentage back to him for developing Perma Ethos TV, which will be eventually at permaethos.tv, and right now it's just a concept, but it's probably going to be out pretty quick, where we are doing real reality TV, not non-reality TV like you see on television, actual videos of actual people doing actual work on permaculture farms, specifically Elijah Spring to begin with, our wolfers, our tenant farmers, Joe, the actual work being done. So you were asking about people seeing everything that's going on, and yeah, a lot of it's blended into the PDC, but the PDC is a 72-hour PDC based on the 14 chapters. We're releasing Permaculture TV, Perma Ethos TV, that is going to actually chronicle on a weekly basis all the ongoings as a subscription service. And one of the cool things that we're doing for our people that signed up for the PDC is we'll probably have that actually running full tilt before the PDC is really running full tilt. So we're going to give them a trial period for free on it, and everybody else, it's going to be a low monthly fee. And basically, you can have all the permaculture content you ever dreamed of, full quality, HD, great audio, professionally produced by a guy. And I mean, you can look, the guy's name is Kelly Herrin. And if I spell it wrong, Joe, correct me. H-E-R-R-I-N. It's correct,
it.
Right? All right, because I messed up spelling all the time. I'm dyslexic. If you look up his IMDb, his Internet Movie Database profile, this guy's been working in Hollywood for 2 decades. He's got a company called All in One. All in One in Truck or something like that? Was it
All in One Truck?
All in One Truck. So he's got a full rolling movie studio on a truck that's doing the production of not just the PDC and the B course that Michael Jordan's doing, but the permaculture TV thing. And what he's basically said to us is, I've been trying to get out of Los Angeles for 10 years. And this is my opportunity. This is my opportunity to do that. So, I mean, this guy's coming out. He's building his own tiny house on our property. He's living there. He's chronicling what we're doing at a level of quality of content that's probably never been seen before with the quantity going with it. So, I mean, guys like Jeff, the guy you just helped, I can't think of his name now, but the guy from Canada with Permaculture Orchard and all, they've done really great jobs. What are they producing? 1-2 hour documentaries? We're talking about that type of content on an ongoing basis weekly. And that's Perma Ethos TV. And we're like way excited about it because you were talking about how when I'm teaching at like a PDC level, I'm teaching the ethics, and you're trying to teach a guy to make a wood pile and not break the saw. That's our way to reach that broader audience. We want to make permaculture cool. We want people to be able to look at that and go, I want to be able to do not all of it, but that one thing, and get them to take and put a toe in the water and do it, and not do it with Hollywood theatrics and creating false dramas and things like that. Like you see on Discovery and Learning Channel, all that. We want to just show them what really goes on, what really happens, the trials, the victories, the failures, all of it, and be completely honest about it. So Perma Ethos TV is something that, like, when we put the whole idea together, we never saw that. But when Kelly Herrin came out and met with Joe and I to talk about a different project, as we put that together, we became ridiculously excited about it, and we could not have a better person to do that. I mean, you just don't get someone with this type of qualification willing to take the gamble and make the content for you. And you know, there's a big upside for him and the company in it. And you know, hopefully Kelly will never see Los Angeles again.
Oh man, and having him on site has been really incredible in opening my eyes for me, this TV, because he's already got hundreds of hours and he shows it to me and I'm like, yeah, that's exactly what the real reality TV should be. This is exactly what we're looking for and what we want to share with the world. And I'm really excited for it. It's incredible.
Okay. So it's going to be available for a subscription. Is it available now?
It will be available soon.
And so then for the people, for my pod people that are listening to this right now, and they're like, yeah, I could like to look into that. How do they get notified when it's ready?
Go to permaethos.com and sign up for the newsletter. You will be notified.
Okay. And just so if anybody thinks that I am mean because I say how bad government is, one of the things that we're dragging our heels just a little bit on here is figuring out where we're actually going to sell this product from, because Perma Ethos is a Texas corporation, and Texas is a good business environment. except in some businesses, which when you're delivering streaming video content over the internet, guess what Texas says you're doing, Paul? Cable television service. Why does that matter, you ask? I'll tell you. Great question. It is because if you are sitting in Arlington, Texas, I have to charge you sales tax based on the fact that you're in Arlington, Texas, not based on the fact that I'm selling to you from Fort Worth, Texas. So every single municipality I have to go through manually one at a time when I file our monthly sales tax to the comptroller of the state of Texas, and over $500 in sales tax takes me like 25 hours of work to pay properly. So one of the things we have to determine as we go forward is a point of sale that's not in Texas and exactly how we do that to start offering PermaEthos TV. So we may set up a point of sale in West Virginia. We may set up a sub-corporation. One way or another, we have to do this. And I want to be clear. We don't have any problem charging the customer sales tax and giving the sales tax to the state of Texas. We have a problem with the massive amount of work it takes to be able to do it the way they want it done, because it's logistically almost impossible. We had about 110 people sign up for the PDC out of the state of Texas, and it took hours and hours. And if we build PermaEthos TV into what we think it can be, and we have a couple thousand subscribers in the state of Texas, you know, we'll have to have a full-time person just to file sales tax in the state of Texas. So when you hear a business person bitch about the government, it's not always because, oh, we have to pay a tax. A lot of times, it's all of the BS that we have to deal with to be able to comply with their version of their law. And in this case, it's just logistics. So, you know, we may locate a sales office in West Virginia or something like that where we don't have to do this. So there's a great example of government screwing stuff up.
Paul, what's the sales tax in Montana?
0.000000.
So maybe we need a point of sale office in Montana so we just don't have to file it. I mean, I talked about doing Delaware for the same reason. You do have to have a registered agent and things like that. But these are, again, when you know we were talking about like element partners and business plans and all, you want to make a living farming or teaching farming or in educate. All of these things always come back and hit you, and you never know how they're going to hit you until you get into the ring, so to speak. And you'll always find something. I mean, kind of like, you know, my little spiel here at the end. In the permaculture world, I find that people latch onto something they want to get done. Some sort of thing they think is noble and justified and worth doing. And they find there's something in the way. And that thing is always initially money. If I only had enough money, I could get this done. And if they are dedicated and they really believe what they're saying, do you know what happens, Paul? They always figure out a way to solve the money problem. And the money problem is never that difficult. The next problem you'll run into when you try to feed people is our government. And that problem is complicated. And so if any of our anarcho-libertarian comments today turned anybody off, this is why. It's not greedy capitalists, like some people think. It's that we're trying to change the world for the better. And you mentioned that PermaEthos 1, 2, and now 3 that's actually operational. Those first two versions were headed off by just, it was like, it costs too much, it's too much trouble, it's too much government, it's either the Federal Trade Commission getting in the way or local ordinances getting in the way, and we had to find a way around them. And the goal of PermaEthos for me has never been to make a lot of money. It's been to radically change the world through permaculture. And it's the only thing that could have drug me back into, let's call it a corporate world. It's the only thing that could have put me back into that, because, frankly, I can sit here and do podcasts for the rest of my life and be just fine. And it's always been the hurdle of government that's made change for the better of mankind difficult. I know there's people in your audience that will have a real hard time with that statement. But if you get in the game and actually start trying to feed people and improve people's lives and help people and empower them to build their own business and their own income streams, you won't find money the problem. You'll find the man the problem. But I'll tell you what, that doesn't mean it's not worth doing.
True. So people can go to permaethos.com and they can sign up for the newsletter, and then when PermaEthos TV is available, then there will be something sent out to say, it's up, it's up, it's happening.
I'm sure Joe will tell you over and over and over again if you sign up now, get it now. Yeah, seriously, we will. And I think that it's going to be something that, you know, we'll try to make as affordable as possible. We do have overhead, obviously, and a guy like Kelly is not free. We can't just share his surplus. But it will be something that, you know, anybody that's not living in a box will be able to afford, I think.
Okay. So you don't have any numbers yet. It's just it'll be greater than zero and less than $1 million. It'll probably less than $1,000.
It won't be $10 a month. The exact number until we have a final decision from all owners. I just simply do not make statements on behalf of the company without a consensus of all owners.
I
just don't do that because we have talk about a memorandum of understanding with Joel Salatin. We have an understanding amongst our members that we will find a consensus, not a majority. Real quick though, you mentioned that and I thought about it and I didn't say it. The most awesome thing in Joel Salatin's memorandum of understanding is both parties agree to never sue the other party. That was worth traveling to California to hear for Permaculture Voices. We will solve our own problem as men. We will not involve the government.
So I too think that was really cool. Although I kind of wonder how much weight it actually has in a courtroom, but I at least like the idea that they're going to, you know, suggest it.
We actually have in our shareholders agreement, Paul, inside our company, by our operations agreement, we are required first on any situation to seek non-binding arbitration, which is a third-party arbitrator service, not a government facility. We are required, and it 100% holds weight. So if one partner wants to, like, sue the other partners, they have to go through that process. And after that, they're required, if we have a non-binding arbitration, which means we don't have to do it, we all go to somebody, we plead our case, they say, this is what I think you should do, and somebody says, I don't want to do this, then we go to binding arbitration. And we cannot and will not involve a court of law in resolving our internal conflicts. And that's the type of thing we want to set up with all of our partners. And if you write the contract properly, it absolutely holds weight in a court of law. I don't know if Joel's does, but the way we do it, yes, it does.
I've got my own way of trying to do business. I like the idea that everybody can walk away from a deal at any given time, or that the deal, if it's not something you can walk away from, you're making a commitment to do something, that the whole thing will be over quickly. Like, you
finish your commitment and then we walk. Yeah.
I like, so like Bart and I have a business deal for each of the DVD series that we create. And once the initial release is done, our transaction is complete. We each have a license to sell as many copies as we want, and we can walk away from each other. But then it's like, and if we want, we can also come together and do another one.
Sure.
And so it's like we want to be able to part on such awesome terms that we can do it again. So I keep getting people that are like, oh, I want to enter into this business deal where for the rest of our lives we're going to calculate out once a month who gets how many dollars. And it's kind of like, no, I do not want to be have that much math in my life. That's like this obligatory math every month. I want to go live the life of a poet and not think of these things.
Yeah, I've only ever met one person I want to marry, and I think it'll stay the number one.
I like the idea of residual income streams, where you get a thing set up with some machine somewhere, and then money just starts coming into your account.
It spits out the number, absolutely, yeah.
You don't have to think about anything.
Yeah, I'll take a videographer, and I'll say, you do this, it works, you have a royalty of 15% or whatever, and then the computer says every month, pay so-and-so X, that I have no problem with. But full-on restrictions on what I do in the future or you do in the future or laborious calculations every month is just not good business.
Yeah. So I think I've got a podcast on residual income streams, and that's where my philosophies are. But that's a different thing for a different day. What I want to do is I want to wrap up talking about Perma Ethos, and then I've got one last tiny thing to talk about. But on Perma Ethos, we have anything else we want to say about Perma Ethos right now? That silence means no.
I'll leave that with Joe. I don't.
Nope, I'm good. I think we covered.
So, to the last little thing. First, I want to express my gratitude and thanks to Jack for getting me started in creating a podcast. I believe it was Jack's fans who heard me on Jack's show and like somehow cornered Jocelyn or convinced Jocelyn to get me to start making my own podcast. And those people did a bunch of things too, and the podcast started. So if it wasn't for Jack and his fans, this podcast would not exist. And we're almost to 300 podcasts now. So
that's awesome,
Paul.
Thank
you for that, Jack. And then the next thing is that for two of my Kickstarters, well, actually I think for three of my Kickstarters, you have put in support for two of them. You've put in a huge amount of support, and I got a lot of money out of it. And I know that for one of them, you mentioned that in the video stuff, you're talking about, and we're going to have good sound quality. And I thought, oh, that's a jab to me, isn't it?
That really wasn't, but I'll actually tell you why I pointed that out. It really didn't have anything to do with you, though you did have one video with some pretty shitty sound quality. But that's neither here nor there. One of my mentors on trying to make my video better is a guy named Shannon Appleby, who did videos for a long time for Harley Davidson motorcycles. And he always just wanted to make movies and videos. And one day he got to meet his absolute hero, Steven Spielberg. And he said, when he met his mentor, he said, what is the one thing you can tell me about making great video? And he said, Spielberg told him, make wonderful audio for your video. And if you do that, your video will convey what you want. And that kind of hit me. And, you know, I do the best I can. I have wind and crap and all. And I'm just a guy in a backyard trying to chronicle what I'm doing. But when it comes to providing something to somebody that they're going to pay for, I really can't think of a higher authority on doing that the right way than Spielberg. You know, I mean, whether you love his movies or not, you can't deny his success. And that has just always stuck with me, that if you want to make great video, make great audio. And, I don't know if you know somebody that's probably more qualified to say how to make great video programming, but I don't. And there's an example of not good audio.
On that note,
that was awesome. We could have never done that if we tried. That was great.
Little right burn,
like
just right
or
so,
anyway, Paul, thank you for having us on today.
Wait.
I really appreciate it.
I got to wrap up the thing. I got a thing to wrap up still.
Okay.
So of course, with the you gave me huge support for my Rocket Mass Heater DVD. And then I made you the supreme executive producer with Bacon, Cheese, and Sparkles.
Yeah.
And then later you confided in me two items. One is you don't feel like a very sparkly person.
No, I'm not sparkly.
And so, and two, it was a little weird when you heard it because the sound quality wasn't that good. And it's like, yeah, I was just videoing. I didn't know. And now we've got Bart now, who's like very adamant about good sound quality. But there's that, and then the last one, you supported my World Domination Gardening Kickstarter, and in that one, we just put a big thing. So now you've seen this. How much of it have you watched of the three DVDs?
I watched the first one. That's the only one I've seen so far.
Sound quality.
I still haven't gotten my copy.
So Josiah, I thought I set you up with like the streaming version. But I think that might have been like before all the streaming stuff got flushed down the toilet, thanks to a lovely configuration in Vimeo called, oh, do you want to use this over here also? Yes. Okay. We just flushed all your settings down the toilet.
Oh,
nice.
Think
that's what you probably want. So we tried to put it all back, so maybe you got overlooked, and I can get that back to you. But, so Jack, you've seen one of the three DVDs, and of course, was your little introduction, the thanks to you in the video, was that acceptable for...
Oh, that was great. That was great. Let me say something about that video. I actually really love what you did with that, because you showed all the preliminary stuff. All the let's evaluate the site, let's think about this, before you were married to the design decisions. And I think with a lot of the documentaries in permaculture, what you see is the orchard as it exists today, 20 years later or something like that. And I know that people want to see that because it's awesome, and I love seeing it. But if I want to design something, then I need to see you go out to a place that sucks and make it not suck anymore. And that's what you were able to do. And I think that we need more of that from people making videos in the permaculture world. Let's show the development, and let's show some indecision without making it fake like reality TV. Let's show people sitting there and discussing and go, I'm not sure, maybe we do this. And let's actually see that, because if I hire you as a consultant, that's what I'm paying for, is that time. And I don't think we have enough video content of that. So I'm looking forward to seeing the next two. But that sold me on what you did right there, because that is what a person needs to see to understand, number one, how do I do this myself? And number two, if I hire someone to come and consult, how's it going to go down? They're not just going to walk in and go, here, go.
No.
They're going to need to talk, discuss, walk the site, understand the considerations of design, not just the physical considerations of design, but things like, well, there's neighbors here. Yeah, let's not put a great big thing in that's going to wash down and go see them, right? Or mess things up for them. What you'd call a social design consideration. So very, very well done, Paul. I have only seen the first one just due to time restrictions, but what I've seen has been great.
Oh, good. Good. I'm glad you like it. And of course the sound was good.
You
don't have any problem having your name on that one?
No, none.
Okay. All right. Good.
And Joe helped you out quite a bit too, man, you know.
Oh, good. Well, yeah, we got, I actually, in the video, I give thanks to Josiah too, in the video towards the end. I mean, not as much as what I gave to you and the survivalpodcast.com, but it's in there. I mean, basically what I did was, is I looked at my stats at the end of the Kickstarter, and for everybody that, you know, brought in a significant number of dollars to the Kickstarter, I wanted to make sure that they got healthy thanks in the actual product. So I'm very grateful for that. And then the thing is like that one last little tidbit, that this is a lead in to the last little tidbit, and that is that you and I have exchanged a lot of emails about Kickstarter, and of course you're grooving on Permaculture Orchard, for which I'm listed as the supreme executive producer.
You are. You had many sparkles and much bacon. Yes.
I think that the thing is that you sent me that email to say, look at all the money that I raised without Kickstarter. And it's like, and I sent you back a long email in which I kind of spelled out like, well, Kickstarter actually takes this amount of percentage. So it's like, but the bottom line is that, you know, you had some cut out of yours as well. When people were probably paying, most people probably paid with PayPal, I'm guessing.
Correct.
Yeah, and PayPal takes a cut. So
it's not much, though. In the end, it adds up to be about 1.25%. It's not 8.
It's not 8. I think it's 3.5.
No, it's really not. When it's all said and done, it's less than 2%.
It varies.
If you're doing low dollar sales, see, and that's the other thing, too. So, like, and your Kickstarters, you're doing some $1, $3, $5 stuff. We had one thing, one price, and
yeah,
done. And I'll tell you, the biggest thing for us wasn't the percentage. It was flexibility. So when you do Kickstarter, they're like, you sell whatever you sell, And then whatever your product is, you must sell it through us for 60 days or whatever it is afterward, where we were able to sit at the end of our 2.5-hour launch and go, holy crap, we need to do something, work it out, and come back with a secondary offering and to be flexible that way. And I just don't think we could have been as flexible as we were. We couldn't have been as limiting as we were. We couldn't have been as generous to our audience as we were. We couldn't have had the freedom that we did with Kickstarter. And my thing is, I've seen people like you do really well on Kickstarter. I've seen people that have done a really good job, have a really good product, really good concept, and not fund on Kickstarter.
Yeah.
And my problem with that is they probably could have done just as much without Kickstarter. And I'm not saying Kickstarter is bad. I'm just saying that the most successful people that use Kickstarter have huge communities and huge networks. And they could probably harness those huge communities and huge networks without a third party that's, to me, providing a web page that I could build for myself in 15 minutes. And if you want to go that route, I have no problems with it. I've sent people to you. Like, if Paul says he can help you, go with Paul. Paul is like a freaking Yoda of Kickstarter. But my thought is, if you can make it happen without them, why do you need them?
So I want to answer that exact question.
Okay.
And then maybe you've got something to say about my answer. But here's what I see when I use Kickstarter, because you're right. And plus, part of it is that I go out and I'll use Kickstarter and I'll use all of my network and stuff, and I'll get, like, on the World Domination Gardening, we wanted $18,000 to do it. And then I went and I hit my daily-ish email people twice, and then I had it up on the Permies website. And after 3 days, it was pretty clear that people from the daily-ish email were done, and we'd only collected like $10,000.
Okay.
And so it's like, okay, so my network is not as big as yours, obviously. So
I'm not sure about that, Paul. I mean, I've been pretty impressed with what you've been able to do. And see, here's the thing, right? So what was the next thing you did? Well, you reach out to your extended network like me. Well, you think if you would have came to me and said, Jack, I've got this new product. It's awesome. Check it out. And if it was on permies.com instead of Kickstarter, I would have been like, you know what, dude? It's not on Kickstarter, so screw up. I'm not supporting you. I would have still supported you, and I think most of your network would have. So unless you're going to tell me that there was this huge sweep in at the end that all came from people who knew not of you or me or any of your other extended networks from them, then I'm going to say you probably could have done it without them. If that happened, then they were probably the right fit for you.
So everything you're saying is true. And it's like I could have had an open thing where it's like, hey, if people support me this much money, if I get this much money in so many days, I mean, I could have basically done a Kickstarter without Kickstarter, without any Kickstarter-like entity. Absolutely true. Now let's talk about what Kickstarter provides, I believe. And that is that if your product does well, you get put on their popular list. And then you'll get a bunch of people supporting your Kickstarter because they're there to Kickstarter to support somebody else's Kickstarter. So there's some of that. But I have to say, just for the record, for all the Kickstarters that I've done, I've gotten extremely little money from that.
Okay.
Now this is where I turn, where I'm going to go to you, and I'm going to say, if you had done your thing and routed it through Kickstarter, now, of course, you didn't need the extra money or the extra, you know, stuff. You would have.
We sold out.
Done. Yeah, you have said
we have a
limit of 1,000, and then the whole Kickstarter ends after 2 hours.
Correct.
And so it's done. But here's a couple of things. A, you probably would have rocketed to the top of the popular list, and granted, you might have accidentally gotten two or three people who would have actually paid for it, thus blocking out two or three of your dedicated listeners, which would have been unfortunate. That would have been contrary probably to your wishes.
Absolutely.
But here's what it would have done that's a positive, and that is that it would have probably made several thousand people aware of permaculture and what you're doing that otherwise would have never have heard about it. And on top of that, their first exposure to permaculture would have been something that is substantial instead of something that's blowing rainbows out your ass. And on top of that, maybe a third of them have heard of the word permaculture before, but they would have looked at it and they would have thought, well, I thought permaculture was about blowing rainbows out your ass. And instead they would have learned that it's no, it's something substantial. And so I think that that was a missed opportunity. Now, granted, I agree with your analysis. That's like, if you're going to run something that's going to be low funded anyway, it's not going to make the popular list at Kickstarter, so it really isn't going to be doing you much good. So that's all I wanted to say, is that from my knowledge of Kickstarter, this was in some ways a missed opportunity. And if it were an open-ended thing for 30 days or even 10 days or something like that, I suspect that with the amount of traffic that you would have been getting, that you may have been able to collect more money than they would have taken.
If we were trying to raise a couple $1 million, the explosion that we could have created with our network may have transpired over the Kickstarter network. I think the odds are pretty long, and here's my thing. One of my favorite founders of this country is a dude named Thomas Jefferson. You may have heard of him before.
Okay.
Right? He's a pretty cool guy. And one of his biggest pieces of advice to the people of this country going forward was to avoid entangling alliances. And one of the reasons I ally with you, Paul, is because we have this very clear understanding. This is what I think. This is what you think. And we don't agree on some things, and we might even tell each other to F off once in a while. And we're okay with that. We don't have an entangling alliance. We have a common agenda, a common goal. We work together and we support each other. To me, Kickstarter is the very definition of an entangling alliance. You're telling me how I must market and sell my product for a period of 2 months after you've done whatever you can do for me. And at that point, you've entangled me, and I prefer not to be entangled. But I can see your point with certain things in certain markets. And honestly, if certain people can tie in with certain folks like yourself that have learned the system, what I love about what you did is you started out with this little bitty project on light bulbs, and you used it to teach yourself the ropes, and then you've become very good at working that system. And if that works for you, God bless you with it, and when you do another one, I'll help you with it. But as for me and mine, we shall be independent.
Okay. All right.
The way our founders wished for us to be.
So, yeah, you've sent a couple of people my way, and I have tried to help them in many ways. Hell, Josiah contacted me a few months ago, and I tried to help him. And so it's, yeah. And there have been a couple that I've supported openly, and I'm not sure how much support I do. But one thing I've learned is that if I just do it by myself, the amount of money that comes in is very little. Whereas if I work the system and I try to do the Kickstarter way, I think I bring in 10 times more money.
Then you should keep doing that.
So, but yeah, exactly. And I don't know why, but this is my business philosophy, is you try 100 things, two of them will work out, and you never know in advance which two.
Well, here's what I love about Kickstarter. There are tens of thousands of people who have done something meaningful and made a difference that would never have done it without it. Because even though they could have done it without them, they don't know that. So it took that little life preserver to make them willing to jump in the pool. So, you know, good for them. And I think they've done some really great things. And if they ever figure out how, with the Jobs Act and all the stuff that Congress is dragging their feet on, to actually make the contributions with Kickstarter a capitalization into the company without accredited investors, meaning that it's not taxable income, then they are worth $1 million to everybody that uses them. Until then, I shall stay independent.
Yeah. Oh, I understand. It's been good for me. All right, that's all I got. That's my whole list.
All right, I got to go cook for my wife. Joe's got a farm to run, and we appreciate you having us, Paul.
Thanks for being on the show, guys. And thanks again, Jack, for everything you've done for my empire. I'll talk to you guys later. Bye.
Bye. Bye.
Oh, I forgot to do my thing to say the end.
Oh, well. You want to just say it now?
I turned off the recorder. Oh, you want to say it? Oh, you're recording, so you're going to record
it. I'm recording. If you say it, your guy can edit it out. Go ahead and say it.
If you like this sort of thing, come on out to the forums at permies.com, where we talk about permaculture ethics. No, we don't. Homesteading and permaculture all the time.